God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, though the mountains shake in the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, and though the mountains tremble with its tumult. There is a river whose streams make glad the city of God, the holy tabernacle of the Most High. God is in the midst of the city. It shall not be moved. He will help it when morning dawns. The nations are in an uproar. Kingdoms totter. He utters his voice. The earth melts. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Come, behold the works of the Lord. See what horrors he has brought on the earth. He causes wars to cease to the ends of the earth. He shatters the bow, he cuts off the spear, and he burns the chariots with fire. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted among the earth. The Lord of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. The 46th Psalm has a really odd flow, or kind of a lack of flow to it. I found myself wondering why I chose this passage. There's this refrain of, God is our refuge, God is our refuge, and there's war language, and right smack in the middle of it, there's this description of a city with a river, and it seems so out of place. You know, as the psalmist begins, the words are almost trite. You know, we're all nodding our heads, and we're buying into what he or she is saying. God is our refuge. Amen. We will not fear. We're not afraid. Even though the earth changes and shakes, you know, we're not afraid because God is our refuge. He is our strength, our help in times of trouble. We still gather regularly to proclaim this message, don't we? You know, we sing songs like, You, O Lord, are my refuge. Rock of ages, hide me away, O Lord. Hide me, O thou great Jehovah. But is this really our response? When the earth shakes and the mountains tremble? When hurricanes blow through and earthquakes bring devastation? Do we clear our throats and sing loudly about the Lord of hosts who is with us, the God of Jacob who is our refuge? Or do we stumble and have trouble believing that God is even still here? What does our faith look like in the midst of a shaking earth and a raging sea? We can sing all we want about God being our refuge in times of trouble, but when times of trouble come, we look to ourselves and we look to others. You know, it's not that we shouldn't lean on others and help one another, but the idea that we can do it without God is a very destructive one. And if we want to claim that God is our refuge and our strength, we must depend on him in times of trouble. We must be still and know that he is God and we are not. Despite the changes, the shaking of the mountains and the roaring of the sea, there is this holy city. The psalmist invites us to look into this new reality that we can't readily see. He's painting this vision of a future city of God. Talks about the New Jerusalem and uses this language of poets and prophets. There's a city with a river flowing through it, and it gives life to everything in the city. This is the language used in Ezekiel 47 and Revelation 22. The New Jerusalem is envisioned sort of as a second Eden, with the river that brings fresh water to the trees, and they bear fruit year-round. This New Jerusalem is marked by endless light and life, and the presence of God. And because God is in his holy city, nothing can harm it. A mighty fortress is our God. But we are not yet citizens of this new Jerusalem. You know, we don't still live in the old Jerusalem, but we're not in the new city yet. We live in the in-between times, the already and the not yet. The kingdom has come near to us. You know, we can point to it, and we can see signs, but we're still living in hopeful anticipation. There's a new kingdom emerging under the reign of God, and we are witnesses to it. The nations are raging, kingdoms rise and fall, but God's voice melts the earth. That same voice that spoke all of creation into existence is the voice that speaks to us today. Come, behold the works of Yahweh. What horrors he has set on the earth. I mean, what was the psalmist thinking? You know, you might say, come, behold this beautiful sunset, or look at the rain. But come, behold the works of the Lord, what horrors he has set on the earth. Can you imagine if we had that out on the marquee on the street, you know? Nobody would come. Or maybe some people would, and that's kind of scary. Nevertheless, the psalmist urges us to come, behold the works of the Lord. See what horrors, what devastations he has brought on the earth. The great war God ends all wars. But it's not pretty. It's not without sweat and blood and tears. The psalmist depicts Yahweh as the ultimate war God. And many of you probably know this, but for those that don't, the word host means armies. You know, we think of someone hosting a dinner party or host at a restaurant. And so Yahweh or Lord of hosts, doesn't really make that much sense. But if we use the word armies instead, we get a clearer picture of what this name for God is trying to convey. When Israel called on God as Lord of hosts, Yahweh of hosts, it was using battle language. It was calling upon their war God, sort of like calling God the divine general. And when you call on Yahweh of hosts, you better expect for the ground to be shaking and for the seas to be raging. What you might not expect is that it'll be the very ground underneath your feet that is shaking, and the water under your boat that rages and threatens to consume. Yahweh of armies destroys our weapons of power and domination. He's not coming in to wipe out all of our enemies. The psalmist says he's coming in to destroy our weapons. He destroys those things that we would use to wield power over others. When we think about God destroying weapons and ending all wars, you know, we envision this peaceful coexistence. We imagine a world where nations do not rise up against other nations, where one person does not seek to dominate over another. We envision a world in which the striving for power has ceased. What I'm talking about is so much bigger than just war or pacifism. I'm talking about radical denial of self, giving up privilege for the sake of others, surrender, sacrifice. We're talking about seeing our fellow humans through the eyes of Christ, eyes that do not see race, color, gender, nationality, age, social status. The eyes of Christ see us all as beloved children of God, valuable and gifted. Christ did not come to save only the rich, only the beautiful, the wealthy, the intelligent, the prominent. He came to redeem all of humanity, to bring abundant life to us now, and to give us hope and a future in the New Jerusalem. In the Gospel of John, Jesus says, I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. But this abundant life will not be aligned with the world's standards. You know, to some, we talk about abundant life and they think about accumulating wealth and having the means and the time to do everything they've ever dreamed of doing, having all the possessions you've ever wanted, you know, driving Bentleys and living in a 4,000 square foot mansion on the Santa Barbara Bluffs with this great view of the ocean, traveling to exotic places and having fantastic stories that everyone wants to hear. Some people think about the high they get from shooting heroin or dropping X or snorting crack. These are some of the weapons in our arsenals. Wealth, greed, self-indulgence, pride in our own abilities. But this is not the message of the gospel. This is not abundant life. The message of the gospel has something so much greater to share. Jesus came so that we might have abundant life. He was sacrificed so that all who believe would have eternal life. He is the bread of life. He is the way, the truth, and the life. Before you put on your cynical hats and raise your hand and tell me that life isn't wine and roses for everyone, let me just make the disclaimer, that's not what I'm trying to say. I know life is not easy. You know, I'm only 26 years old, but I know it's not easy. It's not always sunny outside. Hurts come often and unexpectedly. Pain takes time to heal, and we make monumental mistakes for which other people suffer. And we suffer for the mistakes of other people, and life is not fair. We struggle with how to embrace this abundant life offered by Jesus, and with how to get to this new Jerusalem. So how do we get there? Historically, Israel has taken up arms to get there. Even now, battles rage over who will occupy the Holy Land. But we're not just going to point the finger at them. We've also geared up with our own weapons to secure the safety of life as we know it, and to wield power over others. We give lip service to the Lord of hosts being with us and being our refuge. But we're taking up arms and fighting for power. Most of us don't have bows and spears, and with the exceptions of our friends in the military, we don't charge into battle. But we do have our weapons. We have those things that we keep a white-knuckled grip on to help us survive in this world. We've learned that to navigate this world, there are two things that we must have, and they're intimately connected: money and power. And so we strive to obtain these things because we fear what would happen if we did not. You know, there are the poor and the oppressed among us, those nameless, faceless millions. You know, but we want to be in the top minority who control the majority of the world's wealth, and we want to maintain that prestige and the social status that go along with that. Surely there are some of you in here who would protest, you know, who would raise your hand and say, I'm not trying to climb to the top of the corporate ladder. You know, we didn't all grow up in rich families. But we all seek power on some level, if we're honest with ourselves. Now, for some of us, it means trying to control the actions of our spouses and children. For others, it means trying to control our friends and getting other people to follow us. While we usually have good intentions, our motives are not completely pure. You know, but Jesus's were, and he was offered numerous opportunities to seize power and to do good. But he turned them all down. His kingdom life is about giving up power. It's about giving up control and giving up privilege. Kingdom life is having the mind of Christ, who, though he was in the form of God, did not consider equality with God something to be exploited. And so he humbled himself. He emptied himself and took the form of a slave and humbled himself to death. If there's anyone who ever walked the earth who, you know, deserves power, it's Jesus. But he showed us by his example that we're not to concern ourselves with trying to get power. You might be thinking, you know, I'm not really trying to be powerful. But I think deep down, we all want to be in control of our lives. One of the funniest things that kids say, and I'm sure most of us have said it, you know, somebody tells you what to do, and the kids respond, you're not the boss of me. We all want to be our own bosses. You know, we want what we want, when we want it, and no one has the right to tell us otherwise. But God has a different message for us. He reaches down and he says, is that a sword of wealth you have there? Slam. That spear, is that a spear of power? Snap. You are not in control. You are not exalted. You are not almighty. You will not rise up and oppress my creation. I am God. Put down your weapons. Stop your striving. Let go of the pride you have in your own abilities. Be still and know that I am God. I am exalted among the nations. I am exalted among the earth. If we're going to live lives that proclaim that God is God and he is the only one who is exalted, we're going to have to put down our weapons. Whatever we use to get or exert power, we're going to have to put those away and live by faith and be still.